This is episode 42 of The Job. I'm Ray, here with Candace. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
And we're at Need More Designs. Today we're talking to Camus Davis, but first, we did a cool video shoot here yesterday, yeah?
Yeah,
it was awesome. It was Great Notion. Our friends at Great Notion down the street from us are doing this sort of promotional thing that we can't wait to show everyone. It's going to be really cool. That was really weird, having it filmed in here and having to pretend to be having a meeting and it's they're giving directions can you put this on your screen instead of this because it looks better, and it's like, yeah, but I'm actually working on this other project, but hopefully it'll look good.
The part that I found funny was, well, at first when they were filming, I think that we might have thought that sound was on, and so we were trying to have fake conversations. And then at some point we realized, wait, we can actually have actual meetings right now and get some things figured out. Uh-huh. And Floyd's Coffee was so kind in letting us take over their space for a little bit and shoot. They were just very generous, and it's such a beautiful space. Uh-huh. There was one scene where originally it was going to be in our living room, or in our kitchen, I think, or one of theirs. And I think you, days before, had sort of offhandedly said, that scene would look so good at Floyd's. And so the filmmakers had visited over the weekend, and they fell in love with the space also. And so it was sort of a last minute, can we switch locations? And they were so, so sweet.
I was convinced that they were going to kick us out, but they were very nice, and they didn't. I didn't realize how much, when I said it, I was, to me, it's like, well, I've shot video before, and, I do it on my phone. But no, they brought in the whole light setup.
These guys are pro.
Yeah, they are pro.
Yeah, it's nice.
And they brought in, wardrobe, choices for wardrobe, and the talent showed up and all this stuff. I was like, oh, shit, I think I maybe overplayed my hand here, but...
Well, you know that I stopped in the day before and asked also, and
I'm glad you did.
I think I might have given a more realistic version of what actually happened, so they had some... But anyways, you're right. It took over a lot of space, and they were very kind about it, so I really appreciate it, because I think it's just beautiful in that space. And as you could probably see from our Instagram feed, some of the filming happened at Elk Cove, which is stunning.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. It was fun to watch them Instagram a couple of locations that they were shooting at. Mm-hmm. It's really awesome. The goal is to tell, spoiler alert here, but the goal is to tell the story of us while telling the story of a website that we're proud of, and the connection there is us working with a client that we love, and it's told kind of hopefully through the eyes of a person who ends up at their winery, but through the whole experience they're using their that website on different devices. So if we pull this off, if they pull this off, Great Notion folks,
no pressure, guys.
Yeah, no pressure, but it should be, I think it seems like a really good way to, express. We just had this idea, and they kind of ran with it. They kind of came up with a little script and arranged that, they auditioned people, and they, I feel pretty good about it.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. I've seen their work, and it's good.
Yeah.
Similarly, speaking of how awesome everything is, we're hiring a sort of a web designer. Someone who does both design and development. I wanted to write that in the title, but really, we all have an aesthetic here, a taste, an eye for design, and I'm hoping that we can find someone who can help us turn those into actual websites. Continue to do that, because we've been doing it for a while. But so, yeah, visit our website. We're hiring. Are you that unicorn that we're looking for? Anyway, let's talk to Camus. Camus?
Yes.
Thank you for coming down today.
Thank you for
having me. I'm really honored to have you. I'm very excited to talk to you. It's we have a mutual friend who's been raving about your classes, and also I just think you have a really interesting story. So why don't we start? Are you originally from around here?
Yes, hence my name, which is a flower that grows here in Oregon and Washington. So I'm from outside of Eugene, Oregon.
Okay.
In a little farming community called Alvador.
Okay. So I've done a little reading, and it seems like you spent a lot of time in the world of magazines and such publications.
Yeah.
And this was generally sort of food-related writing?
Mostly for the last, I don't know, 5-6 years of the 10 years that I was in magazines, it was food.
Okay. I think the most recent one was, I have so many notes. Was it the Portland Monthly? I'm going to say the wrong one.
That was the last staff job I had.
Okay, okay.
With the magazine.
From there, how did you get to the point where you decided to start the Portland Meat Collective?
It was a long process.
Okay.
I mean, when I left Portland Monthly, I wasn't sure that I didn't want to go back to magazines, but I knew that I wanted to take a break and do something with food that was elemental and transparent and down and dirty, essentially. And for me, that was not cheese making. For me, that was butchery. And I had been thinking, I think before I left Portland Monthly, I'd been writing about meat a little bit, just in terms of, I was a restaurant reviewer, so I would go to restaurants and I would eat a cut of meat that I loved but didn't see in butcher shops, didn't see in grocery stores. And so I started writing about these cuts that I was finding in restaurants but that consumers couldn't find, and asking lots of questions of chefs and the meat distributors in town and then farmers. And what I found out in the process of researching those cuts was that there was a real lack of knowledge about what those where they came from. I mean, most of the chefs I was talking to were not doing whole animal butchery. They were ordering, you know, a bavette steak, and it would come in boxes, and they would open it and cook with it. So, in order to figure out what part of the animal that cut came from, I would have to go to the chef, then the distributor that sent the meat to them, then if I was lucky, maybe the farmer or maybe the meat processing facility. But by the time I got to that point, no one knew other than the meat processing facilities, and they weren't talking to me.
Right.
So I was sort of interested, just from a journalistic perspective, about who knows this stuff, you know? Like, if most of us on the consumer end of things are just opening boxes of cuts, like, where's the chart, you know? Like, where is that hanging up? And then in addition, I was also interested in the fact that the cuts that I wanted to know more about were considered European cuts and not American cuts. And I wanted to know what that meant, you know? Huh. And by that, it's really... They were calling them by European names, not like we didn't have those cuts in America, but
sure.
We had way less sexy names for them than
right.
The Europeans did. So I'd kind of been writing about that, those cuts, and doing research and just thinking about, you know, where does all this come from? Who knows what? And then when I left Portland Monthly, I kind of started just thinking about, you know, what is a skill in the food world that I don't have, that I want to have, that could be practical, useful, and that could also sort of elucidate like an entire world that's invisible to me. And to me, that was butchery.
When you say that you were, so when you were doing this, you would go from, you know, the chef to the distributor, and you're kind of going up the chain, so to speak. What kind of dead end did you hit? Was it just that you were at the point where you were facing a factory that was never going to let you look at where the meat came from, or?
Yeah, I mean, I would go to the chef, I would go to the distributor. The distributor usually bought from a central processing facility, And the central processing facility was where all these farms from all over, not necessarily Oregon farms, were selling their whole animals to. So between the farmer and the processing facility, between the farmer and the slaughterhouse, that's where the knowledge was kept, basically. Yeah. And unfortunately, most of those central processing facilities are humongous and do not want to talk to the public and are nervous, right?
Like, sure.
Maybe because they're doing things not very well, or maybe because there's a lot of connotations attached to, you know, killing animals for food. So what I ended up having to do was go to chefs who were buying whole animals directly from farmers, where there was no middle. I mean, yes, the animals were going to slaughterhouses, but they weren't getting further processed. And then it was the chefs who were doing whole animal butchery that started to teach me, like, oh, there's all this stuff that they get to do with the whole animal if they have that control versus, and all of this knowledge that they have to find in order to deal with a whole animal in their restaurant. That they didn't have to deal with or think about or explore when they were just opening boxes, you know, box cuts, essentially.
Well, I think a lot of people maybe are don't even realize there's a difference between a slaughterhouse and a butcher, or between those two jobs. What point did you even realize that, or that you could actually get the whole animal having been...
I didn't realize how divided the labor was in America until I actually went to France, where I worked with a family that didn't divide any of that labor. So they owned every part of the process of getting meat to the table. So they grew all the grain themselves to feed their pigs. They grew their own pigs. They owned a cooperative slaughterhouse with other farmers, and they took part in the slaughter. They did all of the further processing, making, you know, retail cuts. They did all the curing, making their own hams and bacons, and then they sold it all at markets. So here was this model that was completely opposite from what I had experienced in America, which was farmers taking every single part, or taking part in every single part of the process. And when I saw that, I realized, oh, wow, you know, farmers in America do not, like, once their animal goes to the slaughterhouse, they're done. There's no... They don't have any say. Yeah.
Is there anyone here who does what you saw in France?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. I mean, there are definitely, we're lucky in Oregon to have lots of farmers that do sell directly to consumers or restaurateurs.
Okay.
They're not doing the slaughter themselves. They're usually taking the animal to a slaughterhouse, or they are hiring someone to come and slaughter on the farm. But they are marketing directly to restaurants and to individuals, such that they actually have to know what the cuts are called, and they have to help, you know, consumers. If you wanted to buy a quarter cow from Farmer Joe, you're probably going to say, well, what's in a quarter cow? What cuts do I get? How do I, you know, how much weight is there? How much of it is bones? And so the farmer's going to have to know how to talk that talk. So we do have that in Oregon, but it's very rare. I mean, you know, 99% of the animals that are raised for food in America are factory farmed and part of this very divided labor pool. And then 1% is what, you know, farmers selling directly to consumers who aren't doing factory farming. So it's rare, but that 1% is what inspired me. And what I saw in France is what inspired me to start the Portland Meat Collective.
Okay, excellent. You're going right according to script. No,
great,
I'm just kidding.
Perfect.
when you came back here, was this idea was in your mind? What was the journey here between when you came back and when you started the Meat Collective?
So when I came back from France, I actually didn't have the Portland Meat Collective model in my mind yet. What I thought was, oh, I'll come back, I'll start a whole animal butcher shop like the family in France, or I'll start a bacon cart, or I'll do something sort of on the retail side. But what I wanted to do on the retail side was to use the whole animal like the people in France did and sell the whole animal. And what I quickly realized was that we don't have a consumer base here to support that kind of model. You know, most consumers, when I was in France, most of the consumers we sold to which was all at outdoor markets. If they came and asked for a pork chop and we were out of pork chops, but we had pig's feet, they would buy the pig's feet. No, they wouldn't flinch. You know, it was just like, oh, that's another part of the pig. I would eat that. You know, here, not so much, right? We want the pork chop. We want the bacon. We want the ham. But the rest of that is kind of, that freaks us out. So I thought, well, if I ever want to open a whole animal butcher shop or do anything with whole animals on a retail side, I would have to have the consumer base. And in order to have a consumer base, you need to have a much more educated consumer base. And in order to do that, you need to create some kind of transparent education system for them in which they see, like, all right, you know, if you're going to eat a whole animal, like, this is everything that goes into eating a whole animal, the kill, the cleaning, the processing, all the organs, what you do with them. And you have to really help people understand that a pig is a pig. It's meat and fat and bone, all of it. Like, there's no difference between any of it other than how much a muscle moved or didn't or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was more important to create that consumer base. And at the same time, you know, I was in France and had learned a little bit of butchery and charcuterie and whole animal utilization, but I was by no means a pro. So I wanted to keep learning and I wanted to recreate what I learned in France here and create that kind of hands-on, transparent education for myself and then for my community. So
when you started, did you have an idea of the type of person who would want to be a student of that? And if so, were you surprised by who actually became students?
Yeah, I figured because I had lived in New York for a while and sort of seen meat, how like whole animal butchery and meat became a bit trendy and sort of the next big thing in food. And right actually when I arrived back from France, the New York Times had written an article declaring the butcher as the new rock star. So that was happening when there I came back. Yeah. And so I thought, well, I'll probably just get a bunch of, you know, like young 20-something, like, you know, kids who like to work on farms and butcher whole animals. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's been the opposite. It's been not even the opposite. It's been just all across the board. I mean, ages from high schoolers and younger to 70, 80, 90-year-olds, you know, single parents, married parents, liberals, conservatives, hunters, with a lot of hunters, a lot of fishermen and women, students. We've had people who work in the meat industry who say work at a Safeway meat counter or a Fred Meyer meat counter come to us because they don't ever get to see the whole animal. Mm-hmm. So they come to learn that from us. Doctors, lawyers, students, you know, grandmas, grandpas, it's sort of everywhere, which has been great. I mean, it's which indicates that across the board, people want to know where their food comes from, right?
Sure. Yes, definitely. I'm curious, and you sort of touched on this when you were talking about going to these factories, that they kind of want to keep a low profile because, you know, they're slaughtering huge numbers of animals and a lot of people have a lot of controversial feelings about that. It's a very charged issue. However, almost by definition, what you're doing is pretty high profile. And although it's not the same thing, it's in the same area. Do you feel like... I mean, obviously, you must have expected to be somewhat of a lightning rod for people's strong feelings about this. Has that been helpful? Has it been frustrating? Were you surprised by that? Did you kind of know this was going to happen?
No, I didn't know at all. Yeah, okay. I really went into it like, hey, there's these two sides of the spectrum. Like there's, you know, really militant vegans and then there's all these people just like eating meat and not thinking about it. Surely if I create a dialogue in the middle, everyone will just come to the middle and like talk and be smart about it.
Right.
When in fact, you know, that's sort of been in some ways the opposite case. You know, my goal in starting it was just to say like, on either end of that spectrum, what's being completely left out is like the processes by which meat gets to your table. And there are two kinds. There's the bad kind and there's, you know, what a lot of people call the good kind, right? Mm-hmm. Where the, you know, it's either factory farming or it's that 1%. It's the 99% or it's the 1%. That's what I always say. And so a lot of the reaction to meat eating is, a lot of the angry reactions to meat eating are in response to that 99%, the factory farm, the inhumane treatment of animals, the overeating of meat. I mean, all of that I think is important to be angry about and to talk about, but there's very rarely room for alternatives. There's very rarely room for anything in between, just ignorantly eating factory farm meat and going full bore vegan. Full bore vegan, I guess that doesn't really work, but so to me it was like, well, what's in the middle there? And then of course my philosophy about what's in the middle is like, well, if you are going to eat meat, or you are going to try and eat less meat or better meat or whatever, you better know everything about where it's coming from. You better embrace every part of the process of where that meat's coming from, and you better be honest with yourself and the people around you how that meat got to your table, you know. And I think there's an increasing number of people who do want to be honest about it and grapple with it and, you know, try and kill their own chicken and see if it works for them or not. But a lot of people do not want to go there. And it's even meat eaters, which is so fascinating to me. I mean, I get the angry vegans, you know, whatever, that makes sense. But it's the meat eaters that get mad at us for doing what we do that is so, that think that what we do, which is showing people how to kill a rabbit, for instance, or showing them what to do with a pig head, how to make a pig head into food, which all meat, fat, and bone, it's all part of the same animal. That to them is gross, bizarre, psychopathic, you know, exotic, whatever. But buying meat in styrofoam packages from like an unknown source that came from a really scary place, like, that's not exotic. That's not the horror film. Like, what we do is the horror film, you know, to them. And that seems really backwards to me. And that was surprising to me. Yeah. I really thought that
people were
in
reasonable.
Creating transparency, people, you know, confront transparency. But as it turns out, transparency is, I think, very scary for people.
Yeah.
And even and it's not only transparency about the bad stuff, like factory farm, it's transparency about killing an animal for dinner, you know, which doesn't, whether or not that's bad or not is up to an individual, I think. But yeah, so it was surprising to me. And I didn't go into it trying to be a lightning rod, but here we are, you know. So
I was, when I think in, it was a friend of mine who was very, very activist and who was very much against the factory animal treatment, who convinced me to be a vegetarian in high school. And I was a vegetarian for a long time and then a vegan. And at some point, probably about a decade ago, I came back to eating meat again, partly because of the movement that what you're describing is part of. Because I felt like I could start to understand it and people were starting to be accountable, and you know, the American food culture was kind of undergoing a change. Do you have any personal experience similar to that?
Yeah.
It's the worst leading question ever.
I, too, was a vegetarian. Yes. Yeah. No, I was. I mean, I grew up in Oregon. I grew up in a farming community. I grew up hunting and fishing with my dad and my grandpa. And that's the food that we ate. That's the meat that we ate growing up. Then we moved into Eugene, the big city, as my dad likes to call it. and we, my parents got busy. My dad stopped hunting. We started buying meat from the grocery store. And Eugene, for me, like, I don't know how much my fellow young people really understood factory farming or not, but most of them came from a counterculture background. Their parents had turned vegetarian in the 70s, so I was just sort of surrounded by a vegetarian lifestyle. And so I became one. It wasn't, there was no like, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing this to the chickens. It was like, huh, well, everyone else is eating tofu, so I'm going to eat tofu too. And then after that, I started, you know, because my parents were still eating meat and asking me what the hell I was doing, I had to then come up with some arguments about why I was a vegetarian. Then I started becoming, you know, kind of conscious about factory farming and that kind of thing. I did start eating meat again, obviously, in my college years, mostly because I was a terrible vegetarian and had a very poor diet, which is not all vegetarians. I just was bad at it and became really anemic and decided to just start eating meat again. That's not an argument against vegetarianism, sure. But and then my job became reviewing restaurants, and I didn't have to, but I did want to, you know, be able to write about the meat dishes.
Right.
So I went through a period of just, even when people were starting to become more conscious about alternatives to factory farm meat, I was just eating meat and not thinking about it for a long time, pretty much up until I went to France. But I had always struggled with, okay, where am I on that spectrum? Like, do I want to hunt for all my own food? Do I want to be a vegan? Do I not care? Do I just want to buy meat from wherever? Do I just want to buy organic? We have so many choices now. And it wasn't clear to me, like, which of those choices was real, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And which of them were, like, reactionary and, I don't know, sort of a way to feel better, but not actually an answer to the problem.
Right. When in your classes, or the classes that are taught at the collective, do you feel as if understanding the factory slaughterhouse sort of experience, do you think that's important to a student in the class? Is that part of the class?
Yeah, I mean, we always talk about, okay, the animal we're butchering today was raised this way.
Okay.
This is always, because of where we're getting our animals from, this is not common. The way animals are usually raised are factory farm model. If you took a factory farmed pig and put it next to this pig, here are the differences that you would see. The factory farmed pig, the muscles would be watery, they would be pale, they would not taste like much. This pig that's moved around all of its life, been fed a varied diet, and been allowed to, you know, be a pig and move around, or and just keep using pigs because that's usually what we're working on. This pig has muscles that are much redder in color, less moist, tougher maybe, but more flavor. This pig has more fat. This one has less fat, you know. So we show them the differences in terms of quality of meat. We also always talk about how animals are slaughtered and how, depending on how stressful or not that experience is for the animal, that affects the quality of the meat as well. And then, of course, we also talk about all of the, you know, the animals we're working on in our classes. The farmer, you know, gets it slaughtered on the farm or at a local slaughterhouse, drives it to us, we're done. Factory farm meat, by the time we get, I mean, we can't really get a whole animal from a factory farm. By the time it would come to us, it's ground and it's come from 20 different places. We don't actually know what animal it came from. So we really try to talk about, like, show them how hard it is to source, to understand where that factory farmed burger patty came from versus a whole pig in front of you that came from a farm down the street. Mm-hmm. So I think it is important. And I think, and you know, our goal is to, in our classes, try and get people to basically stop buying factory farm meat and start buying whole animals directly from farmers. They may or may not want to butcher it themselves, but mm-hmm. we can help them figure out, okay, if you buy a whole animal, these are the cuts you're going to get. This is how you can use it. This is how you can make it last, how you can use preservation methods to make it last longer. And here's a butcher that you can trust that will help you break that down for you, and fill your freezer that way. So it's a very different mindset. If mm-hmm. you're going to try to use a whole animal, buy whole animals from local farmers, and then also make it worth your money and your time, right? So, yeah, we definitely try to always talk about those differences.
So what year did the Portland Meat Collective, what year did it start?
I founded it in 2009, and I think we had our first class in early 2010.
Okay. And how has it been going?
Great. I'm shocked at what's happened with it. I mean, I really thought, you know, I'll do a couple classes here and there every year, and it'll mostly be for me and my friends, and that's about it. You know, we do four to six classes a month. They sell out within hours of announcing them. We have wait lists for classes. And now we have people all over the country who want to start their own meat collective. So we just launched a whole nonprofit to help other people start them. And
yeah, I saw you did a Kickstarter. So yeah. Is that part of this? And so how did that go?
Great. Yeah, we did a Kickstarter last year, and we used a lot of that money to help the Olympia and Seattle Meat Collective start in Washington State. And then the rest of that we're using to build, to basically to write a guide, a sort of ebook guide to how to start a meat collective in your community, and then building a website that will be a place where all sort of meat collective constituents, be it owners, students, farmers, instructors, can come and converse and sort of exchange information and advice. So that's, you know, we're working on the technical parts of that now.
Yeah. So this is, so that's sort of the business model is, just setting these up in different cities now, kind of?
Yeah, I'm basically open sourcing the model. I'm not interested in franchising. I'm not interested even in being a consultant. I like the model. I want it to exist in the world. I started it with, you know, on unemployment, basically. Yeah. So I started it with nothing. I made it a sustainable model such that each class pays for itself. And I think it can be a really great way for different kinds of communities, be they urban or rural, to bring together local farmers, local butchers, and then, you know, consumers who want to buy in kind of an alternative economy of meat. And then, you know, the overarching sort of philosophical part of all of this is, okay, so we're teaching people how to, if they still want to eat meat, but they don't eat factory farmed meat, we're teaching them what it takes to eat the non-factory farm meat, what that requires of them. And then when you start to buy whole animals from farmers, when you start to butcher them yourselves or even just use all of the parts, you kind of start to value meat differently. It's not this like thing that you always have access to. It's a special thing. You pay a little more money for it. You, if you butcher it yourself, you work hard to get those cuts into your freezer. And so it kind of becomes a special occasion or a special privilege or an accent to a meal versus this, like, you know, main course for breakfast, lunch, and dinner that we buy for 99 cents from the store every day. So it really changes your whole notion of meat and how it, what role it plays in your diet and your everyday life and that kind of thing. So that's sort of the broad stroke sort of abstract thing that's happened to our students when they take our classes.
It seems like that's, you know, not taking that for granted, that mm-hmm. being something special. It almost seems like perhaps in a way you've come full circle to your childhood when food was hunted and brought mm-hmm. home rather than just coming from the store.
Definitely.
Maybe you finally recaptured
a little bit of that, yeah.
A little bit
and
of that.
And I'm trying to learn bow hunting again, so, you know.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Camus, for talking to me today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Candace, you met with an anthropologist yesterday, which got me to thinking that that's your background.
Yeah. My degree is in anthropology.
You have a degree in anthropology, and here you are.
Undergrad. My undergrad's in anthropology.
Oh, okay. Well.
Yeah. Still a degree, but.
And I've often wondered, it seems like there are parts of our process that you get really excited about, and you've told me before that has to do with your interest in anthropology. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that? Can you tell me about that?
Well, when I was studying anthropology, my main interest was learning about people's stories. And, you know, this was maybe 15 years ago, I would say. But when I was in school, there was a sense that you would learn how to elicit stories or how to observe participant observation and sort of get a sense of what was going on and see patterns and try to figure out why certain things were happening. And you would write about it. And then maybe you would sell the book and or you would maybe get some grants to study, ask some more questions, find out deeper. But it all seemed like you were sort of swooping in from above. You'd, you know, pick a culture and you would observe but be removed. And then you would sell the story or publish it. And there wasn't a lot of sense of how what you were writing about would affect the people that you were writing about, say. It was more like they were your subjects to be studied. And at the end of that, I started to feel a little bit of a discomfort with that disconnect. And one of the things I love with Needmore is the fact that we can do a better job for somebody if we understand their brand and their culture and their customers and their clients and their needs. But instead of me swooping in, studying, and then sort of selling that information for my own use, it feels more like I'm having a direct relationship with the person or brand that I'm trying to understand or study. They're actually asking me to do that research and to give them the information in a way that they can use. And we use it oftentimes to make their websites. So, I think we have a long discovery process, a pretty deep discovery process, where we try to understand who people are and what their unique story is. I think that that's one of the reasons it's actually so hard for us to work on projects where, you know, like we were talking this morning about every once in a while you'll get an RFP and it's like, as part of it, it's, can you show me your idea? And how, you know, the first 20 to 30% of any project for us is really that discovery and diving in and getting to know.
It's a big part of what we do that brings value, because anyone can, not anyone, but just putting a visuals together is one thing, but like, we don't do that without understanding why we're doing it and having a goal right. in mind and understanding where the client is coming from and understanding where their customers are coming from.
I mean, I love design, and I think we have a reputation as a design-focused studio, and I appreciate that. I think a lot of times when people talk about our work, they're talking about the design part. But for me, and I think for you as well, that design comes out of a discovery process where, you know, form and function together. And in the end, we want to make something that is so uniquely our clients and meets their goals, but actually also looks lovely.
Good.
So, you know, yeah, it looks good. So, I don't know. I feel like I use those skills that I learned back then every day.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to talk about because, at least when I was in school, there wasn't a lot of discussion about how you could take those skills and help brands. It had a lot more to do with, I don't know, maybe ending up in nonprofits or in academia. There, I don't remember ever having a discussion about how I could take those skills and use them with somebody who was asking me to tell them more about themselves, basically. That's a really long-winded approach.
I think a lot of people don't realize that about us. Maybe we need to be telling that story better, that we're
telling our own story.
Yeah.
We need an anthropologist in here to help us. Like, it really sometimes is so hard to look at yourself.
Maybe you could find an anthropologist who could come in and help us tell that story who wasn't you.
Right, totally.
You know, I mean, it's almost like, it's true. It's like someone else needs to write it in third person because we can't.
You know, when, so one of the things that I learned when I was in anthropology was to be somewhere and kind of like suspend all, like you would try to get outside of your barriers. So your sense of maybe right or wrong or how the world is constructed and just sort of try to be pure vessel of documentation, of just seeing what's happening and writing it down, but not putting your perspective on it. And that's a really hard thing to do. But sometimes I think that I practice that so much and it's so ingrained in me that I actually have a really hard time not being in that state. I have a kind of a hard time saying, now I want to focus on who I am and what I do and what that means. Because right. I spent years trying to like see those things that were ingrained in me and push them out or let them go or not hold on to them.
Hmm.
It's sort of the opposite process. And I find that to be much more difficult than the sort of participant observer where your cultural constructs don't apply.
Sometimes it seems like we...
Maybe that's why it's so hard for me to make decisions.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, when we talked about that Thoughtbot playbook, and I feel like they have a sort of standard policy of, like, you know, they have the client provide them with five actual users or customers mm-hmm. to do their, like, usability testing and stuff with. I think maybe we need a more standard... I think, you know, our clients have no idea really what to expect from our process when they work with us to some degree. And I think maybe we could do a better job of just saying, like, look, we need this and this and this from you. And we're going to do this research, whether you think we need to or not, just so that we can guarantee, yeah. you know, we can better guarantee a successful outcome.
You know, our proposals talk a lot about that. However... I would like to get more of it on our website so that potential clients are kind of seeing that information before we're sending a budget. Mm. You know, just so they can see if they are interested in being part of that process or not.
Maybe you could write that in our playbook.
Ooh, did I just get an assignment?
Yep. Yeah. We'll check in next week.
Okay.